You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, when independent pharmacies close, it can have a big impact on their communities. We'll talk to a researcher about how pharmacies in rural areas are doing during the pandemic. Now, new research estimates that 14% of the world's tree species have yet to be discovered. That amounts to over 9,000 types of tree. One of the authors of the paper joins us now for a look at the quest to find those trees. Peter Reich is a professor of forest ecology at the University of Minnesota and director of the Institute for Global Change Biology at the University of Michigan. Peter, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Well, thank you.
Well, step one here, 73,000 tree species you and your colleagues estimate in this report. How do you start to come up with a number like that?
Well, that's a great question. The way we did it is we built the world's largest database on forests with more than 40 million trees from more than 90 countries by building a consortium of scientists who are willing to work together and share their data. So the first thing was putting all that data together. And when we did that, we were able to count there are maybe 64,000 tree species we already know about. But then the kind of magical part was like, well, we know we haven't found all the tree species. And so we used some modern novel statistics to estimate the number of trees we have yet to discover from the number of trees that we only found once or twice or three times in our sample, because the ratio of those and some other equations together give us an estimate of how many we haven't yet encountered in any given sample.
So approximately 9,200 kinds of trees may exist on this earth that haven't been discovered and cataloged yet. That seems like a lot.
It does seem like a lot. And I should mention that probably some of those trees were known to indigenous people, but probably not all of them. But there's those 9,200 are not known to Western scientists. And it does seem like a lot, but actually we had two different kind of responses from our co-authors. Some who work in places like Wisconsin or Europe were surprised that there were that many species we had not yet found. But others who work in the tropics, they think we may have more that we haven't yet found because they know how sparsely we've sampled forests in the Amazon and in Africa and in Southeast Asia and other places like that.
Yeah, can you talk more about those ecosystems, especially those tropical ecosystems, where there may be a lot of potentially these rare trees?
Yeah, well, it's the perfect storm of ignorance, if you will, on the part of science, that the place where the diversity is highest in any one location and highest across the landscape or region are the tropics and subtropics in South America, Central America, Mexico, Africa, Southeast Asia, and the like. And those are places where scientists have not gone and sampled very much. So there's a lot of diversity, and we've only sampled some of it. And so those are the places where the greatest amount of known diversity is, but also the greatest amount of unknown diversity. So that's where we could look to find all those other 9,300 species we haven't yet found.
Now, that sounds cool in the sense that we could discover more stuff. It also seems worrisome. We hear places like the Amazon, a lot of impingement on those, destruction of parts of those ecosystems. It's possible that a rare tree could go extinct and we don't even notice it.
Exactly. And that's kind of my next kind of point on why this is important, is that we know we're losing diversity, and diversity helps maintain forests healthy, helps maintain our forests in a healthy and resilient state. But if we don't even know what we have to begin with, how do we know what we've lost? So knowing more about these trees is very important. But you really hit upon the key thing, and that to me is it's more important to preserve these than it is to learn their names. And that because so many of these tree species are rare, they're more vulnerable to being lost through things like deforestation and climate change. And so this adds urgency to the already urgent task we have of trying to conserve and preserve tropical forests and subtropical forests in every continent where we find them.
I'm talking to Peter Reich, professor of forest ecology at the University of Minnesota, director of the Institute for Global Change Biology at the University of Michigan, about a new paper he was involved in saying there may well be over 9,000 species of trees on this planet Earth as yet unidentified by science. Peter, what kind of efforts are there out there in the scientific world to find and describe these trees?
Well, it seems like perhaps there should be lots of resources in that direction, but it's actually very hard to find money to go ahead and try to sample forests in these remote places where there are often no roads and it's hard to get around. So there are scientists who are very, very actively doing this and devoting much of their time to it, but it's not generally a high priority from scientific agencies. And so it's really through grassroots efforts of scientists who go out and sample maybe 30 different forests, you know, in a country in Africa or Southeast Asia. And then what we were able to do is bring these people together. The scientists, we often don't have incentives to come and work together. We brought everyone together to share their data and together be able to tell a more complete story than any of us could do alone. And hopefully this kind of work will now spur some more action and hopefully some more resources to try to study these forests more in the future and also to act to preserve and conserve them.
And Peter, you mentioned many of these species may be known to indigenous people in, say, these tropical regions. Is there an effort to cooperate, do citizen science with the locals who may have discovered this particular tree species hundreds of years ago?
There for sure are efforts like that going on an ad hoc basis. We have not tried to do that with our network by any means yet, but it's a great idea, and it would be fabulous really try to push that forward as much as possible and do it in a coordinated way.
Now, you and I are both based here in the Midwest. Odds are we're not going to go in our backyard and stumble across one of these as yet unidentified trees, right?
Absolutely. The likelihood of there being an undiscovered tree species in the U.S. mainland or Canada is pretty darn low. But if we just go across the Caribbean or the border into Mexico, there are lots of islands in the tropics and subtropics, Central and South America and in the Caribbean, where there very well might be undiscovered trees.
In just our last minute or so, is there a concern that climate change might be putting these, again, as yet uncatalogued trees at risk in their potentially vulnerable ecosystems?
Yes, and that's to really work both to slow and stop climate change and to preserve forests, is that to date, land use change, things like deforestation, have been the biggest impact on tree diversity and all kinds of diversity in the tropics. But we anticipate in this century that climate change will be become equally or larger in terms of its impact, because climate change is literally changing conditions right out from underneath these trees. And the rare trees have a very narrow set of conditions in which they can thrive in the first place. And now if it's getting warmer and or drier or warmer and drier, they're going to have a tough time. So we need to give them all the help we can by working to slow and stop climate change and slow and stop as much deforestation as we can.
We'll leave it there, Peter. Thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you very much for your interest.
Peter Rice is a professor of forest ecology at the University of Minnesota and director of the Institute for Global Change Biology at the University of Michigan. He talked to us about a paper he co-authored showing that about 14% of tree species in the world have yet to be cataloged by science. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Producer Mary Kate McCoy brings us a story about a conservationist helping farmers make the transition to managed grazing.
When it comes to successful conservation, working well with people can be more important than the science. One conservationist in southern Wisconsin is working to help farmers make the transition to managed grazing, a more environmentally and often financially stable farming practice. This story comes to you from the Grassland 2.0 Project podcast. Here's host Jacob Grace.
Serge Koenig has served Sauk County, Wisconsin for nearly 30 years as a county conservationist. He's seen numerous changes throughout his career, including in his own thinking about conservation. In the past year, Serge has helped transition hundreds of Sauk County acres to managed rotational grazing, a farming practice that is more economically stable for farmers and is often described as the gold standard for soil and water conservation. But Serge's journey to conservation began on the other side of the world during his childhood in Madagascar.
Growing up in Madagascar, we spent time in the woods and in the field all the time. We basically lived outside And when I came to the U.S., it was a natural fit for me to go dive into something that I felt a strong connection to. This was the first job out of college that I got, and I've stayed here. It's been just such a good fit for me. Early on in my career, I was somewhat interested in rotational grazing, but we had a big toolbox that we picked from, and it was just a small tool. These practices were making some difference, but they weren't making the transformative differences that we needed to make.
As Serge spent more time on Wisconsin farms, he became impressed with how well managed grazing worked not just as a conservation practice, but as a profitable business for farmers.
When you look at all the soil health principles, well, managed grazing checks all of them and then some. And so it just made sense to go right to that. When I run the numbers with producers, it's awfully valuable, you know, and you don't have to gross this much when your expenses are this low. And so at the end of the day, it's about what did you get to keep? And so that's a mindset that we're hoping to change. I know when we first started having pasture walks here, maybe 4 or 5 years ago, we'd get 10 people maybe. And lately we've been getting close to 50 people.
Serge believes that the growing interest in managed grazing is not just due to its conservation benefits, but because many Wisconsin farms are actively seeking alternatives after dealing with years of economic hardship.
That's all part of the picture. It isn't just conservation. It's the people on the landscape that really drive the system. The job isn't really about conservation. It's really about working through the people stuff. It just always is. No matter how you slice it, it's always working through the people stuff. And when we approach it that way, just things work better. We don't talk about water quality. We just talk about quality of life, goals, grazing as an alternative, but like what you want, and talk about the finances, and all this other stuff just comes along for the ride. If we don't get that right, it doesn't matter how logical it seems on paper or even on the spreadsheet. It doesn't matter. That's why it has to be coupled with like life stuff. It has to be, and we have to be comfortable talking about that. And yep, you're gonna get yelled at a few times. Yep, it's not gonna be pleasant. And I've had all those things. But like, again, if you're driven in here, if that drive is there and you know your why, that's what we want to help our producers figure out. Why are you doing this? You better know yours. Because, you know, it's not always smooth for you either. But like, if you know your why, it's so much easier to help others figure out what their why is.
This story was brought to you by the Grassland 2.0 Project, which seeks to transform Midwest agriculture through the use of grassland farming systems. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org. I'm Mary Kate McCoy.
Coming up, we'll hear what a tough time for independent pharmacies can mean for rural communities here in the Midwest. That's next on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Now, analysis from University of Iowa's Rural Policy Research Institute shows that over 1,000 of the nation's independent rural pharmacies closed during a recent 15-year period. And the COVID-19 pandemic added more challenges for these small pharmacies. Those closures have created drugstore deserts in hundreds of small communities. Keith Mueller is director of the Rural Policy Research Institute and researches how rural areas get their health care. He recently talked to WPR host Lee Rayburn.
Keith Mueller, as we mentioned at the top of the segment, your research indicates over 1,000 independent rural pharmacies have shuttered their doors between 2003 and 2018. Just how serious has this decline been?
Well, I guess it depends on where you live. I mean, for those of us who live in an area, I happen to live in a suburban area. So if a store closes, an independent pharmacy near me closes, it's not a major thing. But, you know, our interest being a rural research center is we're looking at smaller rural communities. And if the independent closes, that's it. And there's no chain immediately available. And so the difficulty becomes one of obtaining medications that are not long-term medications for chronic illnesses. You can get those through mail order services. But if you need something shorter term, getting that in a timely manner, getting the consultation that you like to have with a pharmacist about reviewing the medication you're taking and or helping you understand the importance of the doses and making sure you take just one pill, or if you have to cut it in half, that you're doing that. And the pharmacist can monitor that because they know how often you're refilling. And just that relationship, the pharmacist is another healthcare provider. And we know that those relationships with our providers, particularly the ones that are dealing with our primary conditions, are critical. So when we start losing that in rural places because of the closure of the independent pharmacy, which was the one that was able to, for a long time, serve a community, that becomes a real issue.
Keith Mueller is the director of the Rural Policy Research Institute at the University of Iowa. He also studies the delivery of healthcare in rural areas. And the issue sounds like a public health concern in rural areas across the country, Keith, in a time when we're looking at public health concerns with the pandemic. And you alluded to it earlier, but would you expand a little more on how the COVID-19 pandemic is affecting rural pharmacies?
Well, and I'll start my answer, Lee, with a takeoff from what you were saying about the importance of pharmacy. And when you hit a time of pandemic, one of the projects we did with our database of where all the pharmacies are was help a lot of different states around the country understand where they had pharmacies that had experience administering vaccines or other medications so that they became outlets for administering the vaccines in the first rollout. We need those kind of outlets, and local rural pharmacies can provide those. I mean, there were national contracts signed with big chains around the country, but they don't reach all of those rural places. And so that's one of the reasons, again, we think the local pharmacy is so important. And what happens during something like a pandemic where it changes how people use services for at least some period of time because you don't get out as much, or you try to avoid going into to crowded places, or you just slow down in what you're doing, that affects any kind of retail business, including the local retail pharmacy. So on the one hand, they're an important outlet for things like the vaccine. On the other hand, they're also subject to, you know, a dramatic shift in demand for their services and demand for the other products that they're selling in the store that help them keep the store open, including the pharmacy.
Are there challenges? Are these just challenges of a free market? Are we dealing with the effects of supply and demand, or is it something else at play here?
Well, there are challenges in a way, of the free market. What they're telling us in part is if you rely entirely on the free market and the exchange of goods for prices, there are places where the market doesn't quite work because you don't have the right level of demand that would attract the retail business into that particular community. And in those kinds of situations, we need to figure out alternatives and or ways that we can help a local service provider stay there. And I worded that generally because it's not just pharmacies that are prey to that. We're talking about them today. So it's an example of the challenges of making, if you rely on the free market as the way of getting goods to people and services to people, well, it may make a lot of sense where you can have competing entities to do that, and you have a lot, and you have customers that are attractive to businesses. If you get into more remote rural communities, those sort of preconditions for how the market could really function well do not exist. And so we need to be aware of that, which is our job as researchers.
So with your work in mind then at the Rural Policy Research Institute at the University of Iowa, as you see it, Keith, what's it going to take to reverse some of these trends and ensure communities can keep getting prescriptions and other vital health care?
A combination of a financial model that can work in a lot of places where the old one has failed us in a sense. And that may mean dealing with, in the prescription drug end of it, dealing with where the dollars flow. I mean, one of the things we found in that second spike I was talking about is the issue related to pharmacy benefit managers who are sort of middle organizations between the wholesaler or the manufacturer and the wholesaler and the retailer. And there seems to be, you know, a need to address how to streamline some of that and take some of that cost out of the system. And that may help bring the shelf price or the price of putting it on the shelf down for the pharmacy. I think the other, so that's one approach, is how do we try to set up an economic model that works. The other is thinking about the service delivery model. And, you know, if it doesn't work to have a high trained pharmacist in a lot of places, what we call the PharmD trained person, does it work to use, and the answer I think is yes, we're seeing around the country, to use telepharmacy services with a technician locally that can fill the prescription. So it's a less level of training, therefore lower cost professional locally. But through the use of telehealth, you can bring that service to the community, including the ability to consult with the PharmD pharmacist who doesn't have to be there for that consultation to happen. So that's the combination that I see as how to get through this.
Keith, thank you for sharing your work with us today.
My pleasure.
That was Rural Policy Research Institute Director Keith Mueller talking to WPR host Lee Rayburn. They talked about the problems that rural communities face when independent pharmacies close down. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, the pandemic will end someday, but COVID probably isn't going to go away completely. We'll find out what it will mean when it becomes an endemic disease instead of a pandemic disease. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Up next, it's news from WPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then we talk to a historian of black cinema about the legacy of Sidney Poitier and how we've seen civil rights issues and the black experience on film change over time. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, U.S. hiring numbers last month beat many economists' expectations. We'll find out why and what the latest numbers tell us about the state of the economic recovery. First, it's been just over a month since the death of legendary black and Bahamian American actor Sidney Poitier. We wanted to talk about his significance along with other black actors and directors who came before and after him, and about the ways that blackness, race, and civil rights issues have been portrayed on film over the years. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you a fan of the work of Sidney Poitier? Do you have a favorite movie role that you'd like to bring up? What do you remember from the first time you saw it? And what questions or thoughts do you have about how Hollywood has given or not given opportunities for black actors and directors to work over the years? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Artel Great is the George and Judy Marcus Endowed Chair in African American Cinema Studies and Assistant Professor of Critical Studies at the San Francisco State University School of Cinema. Artel, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, Rob, glad to be here. Thanks for having me back.
Let's start with the passing of Sidney Poitier. That's what started us thinking about bringing you back onto the show. Can you talk about his career and some of its highlights?
Sure, absolutely. You know, I think it's interesting. Sidney Poitier, without a doubt, was the most important black actor of the 1950s and 60s. I would say, in fact, he was probably the second most important actor of the entire 20th century after only Marlon Brando. He didn't just, you know, open doors. You know, Sidney Poitier blew the doors off the hinges, okay? He was literally, you know, before his arrival, you know, the roles that were created for black actors were really, really limited. In fact, prior to the arrival of Sidney Poitier, black actors were, you know, in Hollywood were really relegated to the margins, and it was pretty bad. I mean, I would say that, you know, if they were not excluded altogether, you had, you know, black characters being portrayed by white actors, you know, wearing this kind of grotesque blackface makeup as a form of minstrelsy to, you know, really degrade black people, or if black actors were actually hired, you know, prior to his arrival, they were really limited in terms of being confined to portraying really regressive and ultimately demeaning roles as like servants or characters who were enslaved on plantations. And these depictions over time were just so toxic. I mean, just very, very toxic. And I think they really worked to crystallize this kind of false image of what Black Americans were. And this encouraged in our society the treatment of Black people as less than full citizens. And I think that, you know, sadly, this still haunts us. These toxic images still haunt the social psychology of Hollywood and America at large. And from within that kind of racial system emerges Sidney Poitier, and he comes with this dignity. He emerges with this pride and this kind of regal essence that speaks to not only his kind of presence, but his power and his ability to transcend so many kind of racial issues in this country.
Here's a listen of to Poitier in the 1967 movie In the Heat of the Night. He's a detective here. He and a white police officer, Gillespie, are visiting a potential suspect, a Mr. Endicott.
Let me understand this. You two came here to question me?
Well, your attitudes, Mr. Endicott, your points of view are a matter of record. Some people, well, let us say the people who work for Mr. Colbert might reasonably regard you as the person least likely to mourn his passing. We were just trying to clarify some of the evidence. Was Mr. Colbert ever in this greenhouse, say last night about midnight?
Gillespie? Yeah. You saw it.
I saw it.
But what are you gonna do about it?
I don't know.
I'll remember that. There was a time when I could have had you shot.
In the Heat of the Night there with Sidney Poitier. Artel, can you talk about In the Heat of the Night? One of the, I think when people think back of memorable Sidney Poitier high-profile movies, one of the big ones.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, this film was explosive and hugely important. So, you know, you have to understand, like, this is 1967 and The Heat of the Night comes out and Poitier is delivering this kind of spectacular performance as Detective Virgil Tibbs, who is a homicide detective from Philly. You know, he's from Philadelphia and he's traveling down to Mississippi to visit his mom, right? But when he arrives in this town, there's a murder that takes place and, you know, Tibbs ends up helping this kind of local inept police department kind of solve this crime. And so in the clip that you just played, it actually is Poitier's character questioning Mr. Endicott, who is this old kind of rich, racist white guy. And he literally, you can hear it in the clip, he slaps Tibbs in the face, mm-hmm. you know, for questioning, you know, him. Like, how dare you, you know, question a white man in Mississippi in 1967, right? And Tibbs immediately, you hear it in the clip, he slaps him right back. Now, this was amazing, like literally amazing. And it's critical because the Poitier kind of retaliation slap was not written into the script at all, right? That wasn't in the script. That was Poitier's idea. And the studio, they didn't want him to do that. You know, they did not want him to do it, but he was able, because he was such a big star at that time, he was able to leverage his star power. And he really insisted, like, no, my character is going to respond to this man accordingly. And so they had to permit him to, you know, respond in that way. And this occurs at a moment, you know, that is like the very beginning of the Black Power struggle. And we start to see this become this important symbolic moment, not just in Black film, but in cinema, you know, broadly speaking. And this scene becomes known, you know, as the slap heard around the world.
Talking to Artal Grade from the San Francisco State University School of Cinema, looking at, so far we've been talking about Sidney Poitier, looking at wider issues of the roles Black actors and directors had in the movie industry. You can join in with your thoughts, your memories, or questions at 800-642-1234. Artal, earlier you mentioned, before Sidney Poitier, not a wide variety of roles in Hollywood movies for Black actors. I know last time I talked to you, you want to make sure we don't forget that there was a lot of other cinema here in the United States, often made by a Black directors featuring Black actors, that you hope we don't lose sight of.
Oh, that's absolutely correct. I mean, there's a 125-year history of filmmaking that exists of Black people really engaging in cinema as this kind of recuperative project, you know, as far back as, you know, the late 1890s, when cinema is first invented. You know, Black people are really at the forefront and the vanguard of innovating this medium and really pushing the boundaries forward. You know, there are directors, there are women, you know, who are working as entrepreneurs, who are helping, you know, develop distribution networks for cinema. And this is all happening before there's even a inkling of a foundation of a Hollywood studio, right? The first Black studio was created in 1910 by a man named William D. Foster in the city of Chicago, actually in the Midwest. It was called the Foster Photoplay Company. And this was the very first kind of successful Black film studio. It was founded really 5 years before the first Hollywood studio was ever founded, which was Universal Pictures in 1915. So, you know, when you think about it, we talk about Sidney Poitier, what we're talking about in terms of his ability to kind of, you know, move the needle. Well, I like to use a sports analogy and say, like, Sidney Poitier was like the Jackie Robinson, right, of Hollywood film. I mean, that's an interesting parallel, because he was respected, but he was also a complicated figure who was a symbol in terms of both the Black community, but Poitier was also a symbol in terms of the white imagination, where his characters, you know, that he portrayed represented, you know, assimilation and the politics of integration, because all of this is happening, you know, during the Cold War period of America. So it's a very kind of complicated range of experiences that Black contributions in cinema really speak to. And Sidney Poitier is an element of that, but he is an element that is kind of really rooted in the mainstream apparatus of cinema itself, and the characters that he was actually allowed to portray during the early part of his career marked this kind of very sanitized version, right, of a Black, you know, person in America. You know, this very sanitized white imagined image of Black American experience.
Talking to Artal Grade, African-American film historian from San Francisco State University. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about how civil rights issues have been? What do you think about how civil rights issues have been portrayed in movies, big or small? Are there titles that come to mind for you? Do you see more roles for Black actors and directors out there? Do you think things like the Oscars need to pay more attention? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our talk with Artal Grate, Chair of African American Cinema Studies, Assistant Professor of Critical Studies at San Francisco State University's School of Cinema, talking about, so far, the legacy of Sidney Poitier and some of the history of the opportunities that Hollywood and independent films have and haven't given actors and directors of color. You could join in if you have thoughts at 800-642-1234 or questions, 800-642-1234. Artel, you suggested a clip to us from a 1973 film, The Spook Who Sat by the Door. Before we give it a listen, can you set up what we're going to hear?
Sure. Well, this film is an independent film made in America, directed by Ivan Dixon, who is probably, you know, most well known for his role in the television series Hogan's Heroes. But the film is actually an adaptation of a protest novel by the writer Sam Greenlee. And in the film, the protagonist is a man named Dan Freeman. Right. Free man. Right. And he is this kind of seemingly passive black character who manages to become the first black person to work for the Central Intelligence Agency. Right. And he works there for a number of years before he leaves the agency and returns home to the city of Chicago, where he uses his knowledge that he learned in the agency to help effect change in his community.
Here's a listen to a part of The Spook Who Sat by the Door.
Get your education, boy, she used to say. Because that's the only thing the white man can't take away from you. And she was right.
You know, I can't figure you, man.
What's the figure?
I mean, what are you in this for? You want power, you want revenge, you know? What is it?
It's simple, Willie. I just want to be free. How about you?
So do I.
And I hate white folks. Hate white folks? This is not about hate white folks. It's about loving freedom enough to die or kill for it if necessary. Now you're going to need more than hate to sustain you when this thing begins. Now, if you feel that way, you're no good to us and you're no good to yourself.
Artel, I have not, I'll be honest, I haven't seen this movie. Make the case that we should go and find it and check it out.
Oh, it's not a surprise, Rob, let me tell you. It's not a surprise that you haven't seen this film, right? This film was, in fact, actively ultimately banned in the United States, you know, in the early part of the 1970s. The film manages to capture the tensions and the, you know, real social turbulence that is taking place in the nation during that time, you know, as like the tail end of the civil rights movement, entering into the black arts and the black power movement. And it directly tackles, you know, issues of class and race through these characters. And this one particular character, you know, Dan Freeman, manages to infiltrate the Central Intelligence Agency, and he uses his knowledge, you know, to awaken kind of critical black consciousness in the city of Chicago, where he actually is able to mobilize, you know, the street gangs and turn them into freedom fighters against oppression. So, you know, this film is very powerful, and it was ultimately banned by the FBI, where they literally deployed agents to theaters and demanded that the film be removed. So the fact that you haven't seen the film is not surprising at all. It was actually actively repressed.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Susie is with us in Williams Bay. Susie, hi.
Hi there. I just wanted to say that In the Heat of the Night is one of my favorite movies of all time. And another movie that comes to mind is Blazing Saddles. And just the fact that the black sheriff was really poking fun at stupid racist white people in that movie.
Susie, thanks for the call. Not by a black filmmaker, is a Mel Brooks movie. I believe he brought in Richard Pryor to help write for Cleavon Little as the star of Blazing Saddles, if I'm not mistaken. But some very frank talk about race in that one, Artel.
Yeah, no, it's a very interesting film. And Richard Pryor was, you know, a co-writer of the screenplay of that. And he actually was supposed to play the role of Cleavon Little, but he was so mercurial, you know, during this period that the studio was like, you know, no, we don't want to come near, you know, him for that particular role. But, you know, what's interesting from that caller in regards to Blazing Saddle is that that film was a Western. And it made me think about, and a lot of people don't know this, but to tie it to Portier as she mentioned her, you know, kind of favorite film being In the Heat of the Night. Well, a lot of people don't know that Poirier started to face a lot of criticism in his career toward the end of the 1960s, particularly from people who felt that, you know, the roles that he was playing were really safe for the consumption of white audiences, where he was playing this likable kind of black figure who was really sanitized. So as he started to take control of his own image, he decided he wanted to step behind the camera and actually start to direct. And he directs his first feature film in 1972. And that film is called Buck and the Preacher. And it stars Poirier, Harry Belafonte, and Ruby Dee. And this is important because the first film he chooses to direct on his own is a Western, right? A black Western. So of all the genres he could have made, why did he want to make a Western? Well, he wanted to make a Western because it's a deeply historicized genre. And he understood that the industry itself had historically, you know, erased the contributions of black people as cowboys in Western films, you know? So this idea of what does a Western look like, or what does a cowboy look like in Hollywood? Well, they look like John Wayne. You know, they don't look like Sidney Poitier. And that is because the Western genre is fundamentally tied to this idea of this quintessential American genre, right? This is the genre that really kind of sets up frontier expansion and understands like how we came to be Americans. But, you know, in the 19th century, like one out of every four cowboys was black, right? But in Hollywood, you don't see that represented. And so Poirier chose to actually use his first film as a director to bring light to this hidden history. And it even, you know, reminds me of the word cowboy itself, right? Which should be interrogated, I would say, because it actually originates from a pejorative term for black ranch hands, right? Perpetuating this kind of racialized practice of calling black men boys. So they were called cowboys as opposed to ranch hands, right? Or cattlemen, like their white counterparts were called.
I want to take a couple minutes, Artel. You are a director and an actor yourself. You have a film project called The Love Cycle, I understand currently in progress, addressing black life and relationships. You study this a lot. What kind of things does that make you think about as you're acting and directing in your own work?
Wow. Well, I think about, you know, really honoring the nuances and rhythms, right, of black life. You know, I spend a lot of time thinking deeply about how I can create work that embodies the full weight and complexity of what it means to be in a black American, particularly given the kind of overall fascination with black pain and suffering. You know, my work with the Love Cycle films is really about how do I recalibrate the national conversation around black lives by focusing on love, you know, and joy, as opposed to, you know, pain and black trauma, right? This is my kind of way of making an intervention and, you know, really reimagining the cultural politics of cinema in a way that's, you know, not only expanding the iconography of black, you know, images, but pushing the boundaries of what black film can be and what that can look like. And doing so in a way that, like I said, embodies the full weight and complexity and the nuance and the interior life of black Americans, because nuance and complexity are important. Black people are multi-layered individuals. You know, they are not one-dimensional, you know, they are not one-dimensional characters. And many people in black communities are really yearning to see themselves in a multi-dimensional way on screen, in a way that's entertaining, but also political and poetic. And that's what I'm doing.
Artel, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Hey, Rob, appreciate you having me.
Artel Great is the George and Judy Marcus Endowed Chair in African American Cinema Studies, Assistant Professor of Critical Studies at the San Francisco State University School of Cinema. He talked with us about actor and director Sidney Poitier, who passed away last month, and how civil rights issues and the black experience have been portrayed on film over the years. Coming up after the news, employers hired a lot of workers last month despite a surge in Omicron cases. We'll break down the latest numbers with a reporter who covers the economy, and you can join in. Have you seen an economic change in your life? Have you changed jobs yourself, or are you one of the people on the sidelines, not going back into the workforce for one reason or another? We would love to hear from you. You can email right now, ideas@wpr.org. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.